once or twice a year, so I'm not always so great with the names. So I'm going to try to write them down this time, so I'm just look at you and pretend I remember your name. So I've got Marion, I've got Celine.
Richard.
Okay, that one I should be able to remember.
Mark.
Sandy.
Bob.
Bobby Cohen.
Lois.
Judy.
Hi, Judy. Nice
to see you. Amy. Anita.
Mark.
Lainey.
Brad.
Jennifer.
Now, don't move.
In the same seats next week?
Yeah, please sit in the same place next week. Just
I know at least one person's coming at 8 o'clock. I told her it was worth it.
So, was anyone not here last week who I didn't already give the handout to? Okay. Don't get up. I'm coming to you.
I realize the other folks who came in, I think I gave out the other handout last week, didn't I?
You gave out two.
Yeah, I did.
And you asked us to read it, and I...
You don't have to say any more.
Yeah. I remember to bring it with me.
There you go.
So wait, so the people who just came in, did I give you this one?
I think it was
I didn't give you guys, I didn't give you this. So for the people who aren't here last week, I'm going to catch you up really fast, but you should ask any questions if I've caught you up too quickly. So, you know, our conversation is around the concept of revelation, and by derivation, it's also about our understanding of how Torah comes to emerge as a text and as a tradition, and by extension, how the traditions about how the Torah emerged come to emerge, because the Torah itself doesn't tell such a clear story. And again, by one step further out, what the sanctity of Torah is if it's not understood in the traditional way as the verbatim revelation of God to Moses at Sinai. And all the way at the end of that line of extension issues that we're thinking about is the authority of Torah, in the sense that if it's not a divinely revealed document that reveals God's will, expectations, commandments, and desires, then how do we know like what we're supposed to do as Jews and what the consequences are for us of doing and not doing various things? So what we looked at last week, for the folks who picked up the handouts just for the first time tonight, the one that goes this way, one that has Exodus 19 on the top, is what we looked at last week. And you can read that on your own. I think the story is probably familiar. This is the primary narrative and actually the only story, as we discussed last week, that exists in the Bible, with the exception of the echo you find in the fifth book of the Torah of Deuteronomy, where the text represents Moses as recapitulating this story from Exodus. Okay, and one of the things we looked at last week is the kind of awkward nature of the choreography of the motion of who's going up the mountain, who's coming down the mountain, the role of Moses, the walk-on part of the elders who are mentioned in verse 7 and then don't seem to do anything, the intercessory role of Moses, and also the appearance of Aaron at some point. And the sense of that Mount Sinai, at least in this story, is sacred boundaried material and can't be approached by regular folks. Okay? So we talked a little bit last week about the sense of Jewish tradition not being as clear as most of us have learned or assumed or inherited, that we don't have any intercessory tradition in Judaism. We have a pretty strong intercessory tradition in Moses as the person who goes to get the information and brings it to the Jewish people. But we'll look at some of the texts tonight that go with that. Hi, welcome.
Joe.
Thank you.
Between Lois
in
and
between
Bobby. Lois and Bobby.
Lois and Bobby, that's right. Oh, I have copies for you. I'll meet you halfway. But I have all this paper. And I made these guys, they came in together, I made them take two copies. And they're going to feel like...
And Anita, do you want your own?
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
That's okay. I can have mine back.
Anita will take her own, too.
You're anticipating a late arrival.
No, Anita has not asked to have her own.
were sharing,
sorry.
But we
oh, I didn't realize you were sharing.
Yes.
Okay.
We decided not to
okay.
share.
That's fine. That's fine.
It's okay.
It's much better you should use up all this paper that I used up. Anyway, the point that I made last week, which I just want to recapitulate and introduce if you weren't here last week, which I think really is consequential for us, especially as Reconstructionists, is that except for this story in Exodus 19, the rest of the Hebrew Bible, the rest of Jewish scripture, doesn't seem to be aware of the tradition of Moses getting the Torah at Mount Sinai, or there being a revelation at Mount Sinai, or it being the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, because all of those things are in play. So one of the things we looked at last week is, we looked at one of the Psalms, there are several Psalms you could look at, to notice that when the Psalms narrate, not all of the Psalms, but the really long Psalms that narrate the history of the world from creation, or the history of the Jewish people, they mention all of the routine things you would remember, like Egypt, wandering in the desert, arriving, you know, in the edge of Palestine or Canaan or Israel, and then entering the land. And none of them mention the revelation at Sinai. They don't mention, oh, and we stopped at Mount Sinai on the way and we got the Torah. And the prophets don't mention it either. So when the prophets castigate the Israelite people for failure to keep the covenant or the laws, they don't appeal to, remember Moses gave us the Torah at Sinai and you're not following it. Remember to follow the Torah that Moses gave us at Sinai. That's your obligation. Remember that the Torah from Sinai is what defines the covenant between God and Israel. So the absence of any information, you know, anywhere else in the Bible is the proverbial argument from silence. So it's not necessarily clear what the argument from silence tells us, but it's passing strange that for a tradition that's so vital to later Judaism, that the Torah was given to Moses at Sinai and hasn't changed ever since, for that not to be mentioned anywhere in the Jewish Bible is curious, right? I mean, it's something to at least to think about. I mean, the Orthodox response that normally is, you know, it's so fundamental and foundational that it's taken for granted. You don't have to, you know, emphasize something that everybody already knows. And mostly, by the way, the Orthodox, but an Orthodox, you know, response to that often would be that response. The other thing I mentioned last week, which will set us up for conversation tonight, I hope, is that in the modern period, which we're jumping to briefly and then going backwards tonight, in the modern period, which really is, you know, the 1800s on in Jewish tradition, in the Western European tradition, and then in the North American tradition, the tradition of the Torah being the verbatim, unchangeable revelation to Moses at Sinai, so that, you know, the Torah that's in the Ark in every synagogue or transcribed in the pages of a book is identical with what Moses knew and the Israelites and the Jews have known ever since, that idea pretty much gets knocked out of the park and is no longer considered academically, historically, archaeologically, intellectually, or religiously defensible. So it's going to set up an opposition between the Torah is perfect, pristine, divine revelation, unchanging for 4,000 millennia. That's the thesis. The antithesis is going to be the Torah is humanly constructed, diverse documentation, threaded together over a period of time, full of inconsistencies, irregularities, and uncertainties, and written by people and not given by God. And that's going to be the antithesis. Okay, so one is it's totally divine, one is it's totally human, and then most of the interesting conversation is going to happen in the middle. And in the middle is going to be the attempt in the 19th and 20th century to retain the sense that Torah is somehow connected to God and somehow connected to revelation without yielding on the kind of irrefutable insight, unless you start from an Orthodox position, that the text reveals itself to be a humanly constructed, multivocal text in which the editorial seams are often really transparent, parenthetically. We're not the first Jews to notice them. The rabbis of the early rabbinic period in the Midrash and the Talmud see the same inconsistencies, irregularities, and discrepancies that modern Jews see. You know, is the flood 40 days or 120 days? The answer is yes. Right? But the rabbis in the Talmud already see this, and they have their own interpretation of why that's the case. You know, Deuteronomy says Passover can only be celebrated in the central sanctuary. Exodus says Passover can only be celebrated in the home. The rabbi saw this 2,000 years ago. We're not the people who discovered these discrepancies. What's different for us as modern Jews is we don't have to reconcile the discrepancies with the doctrine of divine revelation and the unchanging nature of the text, so that you kind of have to shoehorn the contradictions or inconsistencies, or if you like a more neutral term, alternatives, into a theory that somehow it all hangs together anyway. In other words, like for modern Jews, especially for, I think, Reform and Reconstructionist Jews, it's not so crucial to be able to reassemble the text so that it is a consistent document. What becomes interesting is to see the layers and the different voices that are in Torah, because that gives us a sense that the layers and different voices that we bring in 2015 to our Jewish conversations have a pretty strong antecedent, you know, in the oldest text, one of the oldest texts that we know. Just as the prophets are not univocal either. You know, I don't know how many of you, like me, grew up in the Reform movement, but when I grew up in the Reform movement in the 1960s, we were told that it was the prophets that were the main event. As my rabbi used to say, not Leviticus. Because in my stage of life, I really like Leviticus a lot at this point, you know, but that's a whole different conversation. So we were taught that, you know, the prophets, with their emphasis on social justice, especially, you know, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream, that's Amos, and other passages from Isaiah, that was really the core of what God wanted us to do. Of course, when I got to rabbinical school and read, you know, the rest of the prophets, including Ezekiel, who doesn't like the Jews at all, and basically, you know, loves God, doesn't like the Jews, and beats up on them all the time. And then I read some of the other prophets who have equally antagonistic and kind of acerbic views of the world. But prophets, not so consistent either. They don't all see the world the same way. And those of you who are here a year or two ago, I can't remember what year we did the New Testament class.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Thank you. Okay. Well, remember that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then the other one of John, don't see the story of Jesus the same way either. So the earliest Christian community inherits the same tradition, makes sense, they were Jews, of there being multiple recensions of people's understanding of what the main event was. So just like there's multiple recensions of what Jesus was about, there's multiple recensions of what the revelation of the Torah is about, okay? And that's mostly what we tried to cover last week, okay? The sense of thesis, antithesis, and the energy that's going to see what we'll see tonight in the middle. The sense that no place else in the Bible except in this story do we even get a story about Moses and the Torah and the Ten Commandments being revealed. And that's really essential, I think, for us to keep in mind. And I hope enough of a level of comfort, because I don't want to assume everyone thinks the same way here. I don't mean to assume that. So, but I hope a level of comfort with there being alternative understandings of how the Torah came to us besides the traditional one, right? I guess, you know, the softest way that I can put it. So any questions about that stuff? Or anything you guys want to raise at that point? Okay. So this packet, if you can flip to the back page, which is where we left off at the end of last week. I invite you to read this stuff on your own, but especially if you weren't here last week, the next two last pages, which is the thing, this is General Introduction to the Torah. That's Rabbi Plaut in the Reform tradition. And the little corner that says the conservative Chumash or Pentateuch, that's worth taking a look at some point if you didn't look at that last week, okay? So here are two texts that I brought as thesis and antithesis in the 20th century. Now these are a little bit dated, okay? Rabbi Norman Lamb on the left-hand side of the page is the emeritus president of Yeshiva University. And this is from his 1966 commentary symposium article, which was called The State of Jewish Belief. They asked a number of Jewish leaders, I think 25 or 30, five questions. And they asked them all to answer the same five questions. By the way, commentary did this again. Yeah, it should be page 8 of the horizontal packet. Okay? Amy, you got that? Got it? I should have done these in different colors. That's what I usually do when I come here. I didn't do different colors this year. I'm sorry. But it's going this way, if that's helpful. It's going across the page. Oh, yeah, never mind. So, in 1966, one of the five questions that the editors of Commentary Magazine asked all the people they asked to respond to was, in what sense do you consider the Torah to be divine revelation? Okay? Interesting question. So this is Rabbi Lamb's response in 1966. My guess is, you know, most modern Orthodox rabbis would say something like this today as well. He says at the beginning, I believe the Torah is divine revelation in two ways, in that it is God-given and in that it is godly. By God-given, I mean that he willed that man, all the gender stuff is here, is very 1960s, so just roll with it, it's okay. I mean that he willed that man abide by his commandments and that that will was communicated in discrete words and letters. Now that's interesting because that already assumes a conclusion about an unresolved issue, whether revelation is verbal or visual. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the tradition doesn't say, you know, that God wrote a Torah scroll. The tradition says God spoke all these words, not God wrote all these words. So Rabbi Lamb is already giving you like 2,000 years of consolidation of conversation into discrete words and letters, okay? And that's not so clear. We do know, by the way, the tradition in Exodus 34, after Moses breaks the first set of tablets, the golden calf story, that God inscribes the second set. It doesn't say what's inscribed, okay? But even then, we're talking about, you know, cutting into something, not writing something out, you know, longhand, okay? Skipping down to the next paragraph, he said, I accept unapologetically the idea of the verbal revelation of the Torah. So notice he's gone back to the verbal. I do not take seriously the caricature of this idea, which reduces Moses to a secretary taking dictation. Any competing notion of revelation, such as the various, and here come the air quotes to disparage, inspiration theories, can similarly be made to sound absurd by anthropomorphic parallels. The issue there that we're going to look at tonight is that middle ground that I said between the thesis of totally divine and unchanging and the antithesis of totally human and multivocal is there's going to be a whole school of modern Jewish thinkers who want to say, yes, it's human literature, but it's written under divine inspiration. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it different from other literature. That's what makes it worthy of its place in the hierarchy of the system and in the architecture of the sanctuary, by the way. So, you know, why the Torah is still in the Ark. So even when I was growing up in the Reform movement, we didn't have the prophets in the Ark. Right? If the Torah wasn't the most important thing in terms of what we were taught to believe, it was still the most important thing in the sanctuary. We did not take out like Haftorah booklets and walk around the sanctuary with them while people, you know, reached out to touch. Yeah. You just don't do that. It's interesting, by the way, the only other text that's used in the synagogue that still comes out as a scroll is the Megillot, and that's usually only the story of Esther. Mm-hmm. We don't actually read from the Haftarah in a scroll, though there is a story in the New Testament of Jesus doing that when he showed up and they gave him Maftir, apparently. So, if you can skip down to where the italics appear, just sort of below the middle of that column, where he says, how God spoke is a mystery. You see where that is? Mm-hmm. Okay. How God spoke is a mystery. How Moses received this message is an irrelevancy. I would say probably not to everybody. That God spoke is of the utmost significance, and what he said must therefore be intelligible to humans in a human context. Even if one insists upon an endlessly profound mystical overplus of meaning in the text. We'll look at the mystical stuff next week, probably. I don't think we'll get to that this week. So, you know, essentially what he's saying here is the traditional position, which is still the Orthodox position, which emerges sometime, you know, around the first century before the Common Era, first century of the Common Era. It's sort of taken for granted by the time of the Mishnah and then the later, you know, rabbinic period, 200, 300, 400, without actually being, like, declared any place, kind of emerges. And it emerges like most foundational traditions, in an imprecise way, sort of by cohesion, by consensus, right, and by repetition. So by the time you get to the later tradition, it's already assumed by the rabbis to be the case without having to prove it or to say, where do we know that from? Right. So it's already assumed to be a divine text, okay? So this is pretty much the traditional position. On the right side, I gave you some material from Mordecai Kaplan, who founded the Reconstructionist movement. I assume that that's a relatively familiar name to folks here, I hope. And in his book, The Future of the American Jew, which is 1947, which was his sort of restatement of his 1934 book, which you may know better, Judaism as a Civilization. That's his basic textbook. And this was his restatement some 12 years later. He says, the alternative to regarding Judaism as a specific tradition which consists of supernaturally revealed laws and teachings is to regard Judaism as a civilization which is both the product and the incentive of the will to live as a people. Going on to the next thing here, we'll just look at his stuff together and then come back a bit. Evaluated in this light, the Torah may still be considered as a divine revelation in the sense that it testifies to the reality of God as the spirit that promotes righteousness in the world. To assert this is not, however, to affirm what our fathers meant when they spoke of Torah min hashamayim, means Torah from heaven. That's a rabbinic phrase, by the way. You won't find it in the Bible anywhere. The Bible doesn't know the phrase Torah from heaven, Torah min hashamayim. It's a rabbinic concept, okay? It affirms that the Torah reveals God, not that God revealed the Torah. That's a classical Mordecai Kaplan subject-predicate inversion. He does it with Psalm 19, by the way. The Torah of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. Kaplan flips it and said, that which is perfect and restores the soul is the Torah of the Lord. It's classical Kaplan. It's actually a very good technique because it lets you keep the poetry of the tradition without doing violence to it, but understand it in a more contemporary way. So it can either be profoundly meaningful to say that God doesn't reveal the Torah, but the Torah reveals God, or it can be a bumper sticker, you know, that has no particular consequence because it sounds like, you know, a cheap pass at retaining an idea. Really depends upon how seriously you want to delve into it. But what you notice Kaplan's struggling with here, and he does it more here than he did in 1934, by the way, in the original book, he's trying to keep the conversation around Torah connected to the conversation around revelation. He's not willing to let the word revelation go. Whereas his son-in-law, Ira Eisenstein, who really founded the Reconstructionist movement, even though Kaplan founded the ideas, as I mentioned to the folks here last week, wanted to let the word revelation go. And as his generation of Reconstructionism spoke of the word discovery instead of the word revelation, that the Torah is the earliest record of some of the discoveries of the earliest ancestors of our people, about some of what has stood up over the centuries about God. For Ira, it was never all of it. The Torah in its entirety doesn't reveal God because there's some nasty stuff in the Torah associated with God, including the end of the book of Leviticus that's read this Shabbat coming this weekend with all the blessings and curses, or the passage in Deuteronomy about committing genocide against the seven Canaanite nations when the Israelites arrive in the promised land. And that's what it says, by the way. It does not say, you know, like, you may have to go to war with them, but, you know, try to be really nice about it. It says to exterminate them, you know, men, women, children. And so someone like Ira would say, that's not a discovery of what we mean by God. That's a contextually circumscribed text that reflects a voice in the tradition from a period in the tradition that had a very strong opinion about people who weren't Israelites. But it's not the only voice, because the same five books of Moses also says, you should remember the heart of the stranger because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. That's also found in the Torah. So someone like Ira Eisenstein, and I think Mordecai Kaplan would say, that part about the heart of the stranger and you were a stranger, that's closer to what we mean by God. The part about exterminating the seven Canaanite nations, that's further away from what we've grown away from. We don't think that about God. And so the good news is, okay, so we don't have to accept the nasty stuff in the Bible and the Torah as being connected to God. And the challenging piece is, So we only accept the nice stuff? Mm-hmm. Is that like, is that how we know what God really is? It's the nice stuff. Right. One of my teachers once called the all-rightiness of the almightiness. You know, like the debates in the reform movement in the 1970s, when they were first tackling the issue of gay and lesbian inclusivity, which in those days was only called, actually was called homosexual. They didn't use gay and lesbian in the 70s, and they were not up to bisexual, transgender, and queer. So it was just that issue. And a lot of the reform rabbis who in the 70s who were not ready like to go in that direction around marriage, for example, said, but in Leviticus it says, you know, that you can't do that. Which, first of all, is a misreading of Leviticus, but it's not the first time the reform movement's misread Leviticus. But then, you know, other reform rabbis said, and Leviticus 11 says we should keep kosher, by the way, and we don't do that either. Right? So the subjectivity by which modern Jews presume to sit in judgment on the Torah as to what's actually godly is just a challenge, I think, for liberal Jews. I just want to put out there so that we're honest about it. It's a little chutzpahdik. You know, and Orthodox Jews will frequently say to non-Orthodox Jews, because their rabbis frequently say it to non-Orthodox rabbis, like, you don't really think the Torah is from God. You just think whatever you already think that you also find in the Torah is okay, basically.
Well, it's like the response to Dr. Laura Schlesinger. I don't know if she's still on the radio. I stopped listening to her out of exasperation. she would name certain things like, you know, gay relationships, yeah, and other, yeah, things that are forbidden in the Bible, and there was like published where she was picking out what she wanted. If we followed it directly, yeah, then everybody would be, you know, yeah, certain people would be stoned to death and this and that. And
yeah.
Just picking. Just picking.
Yeah. But the picking and choosing, you know, is part of the, I think, tradition in many ways. And it's not, we're, again, like, not the first people to come up with that issue, but we'll come back to it because, again, like, I just want to say, like, for Reconstructionists, you know, and for Reformed Jews as well, but I think more clearly for Reconstructionists, and I tend to fall into this era sometimes, so I have to, like, be careful with it. I don't mean to be arrogant about this or self-righteous about this. I sometimes, you know, start to head in that direction, so I want to kind of dial it back a little bit. And say that, you know, it's I think, a great liberation that Mordecai Kaplan and his disciples gave us to say, you can accept the concept of Torah without accepting every verse of the Torah as your inheritance. In the same way, you know, as I said to people recently, you have, like, the quirky uncle at Thanksgiving who still spouts racist jokes, right? The rest of the family, you know, like, they roll their eyes and they don't speak that way anymore. But that guy, you know, he's still in the family. So your choice is you don't invite him, or you try to convert him, or you just, you know, he's going to say it, you wait for him to say it, he says it, and you move on. Right? In the same way I pass that passage every summer in Deuteronomy about exterminating the seven Canaanite nations, it's like the crazy uncle. Yeah. You know? I mean, that Shabbos, they read that passage, you know, I grit my teeth, and okay, I move on. Okay? But we want to be careful that we don't assume that we've solved the problem of how Torah is meaningful for us. If we simply reduce it to whatever we already agree that we happen to find in Torah, that's okay with us. Because then the challenge of being in dialogue with the tradition and having complacency not become, you know, our essential mitzvah gets lost, right? So, I mean, the Torah tradition really calls us to be challenged by stuff that doesn't always feel so comfortable. And it's easy when you say, well, you know, it's a human document. We just like the stuff we like and the other stuff we just get rid of, to miss the challenge that's in that. So I just want to keep the challenge on the table for us. It's an important issue, especially with Shavuot coming next week. You know, it's, what do we mean by all of this stuff? And in what sense, which we'll see, you know, in the debates tonight or next week, in the 20th century, you know, is there some sense of commandedness? Is there anything outside of us? Hi.
Hi.
Nice to see you again. It's okay. Thanks for being here. Is there anything outside of us that's compelling, or in traditional religious language of Judaism, commanding? You know, is mitzvah a good deed, or is mitzvah an obligation, or is mitzvah a commandment? And as you'll see in the debate between Martin Buber and his colleague Franz Rosenzweig in Germany in the 20s, can you have commandment without commandments? Can you have a sense of we are under obligation to something bigger than ourselves without saying that we have to follow, you know, everything that's in the tradition or that God commanded everything in the tradition, because we know historically that that's not an accurate thing. Okay? So I'm just putting some questions out there at the beginning of tonight just to sort of keep us destabilized. Put in a good way. Okay? At the bottom of the page here, I'm sorry, I missed this part of Kaplan, right? His second paragraph. The modern Jew cannot therefore look to the Torah as a source of authority in the sense that whatever it permits is right and whatever it forbids is wrong. He reverses the process and said, whatever is right should be incorporated in our Torah and whatever is wrong should be eliminated from our Torah. Now, he didn't actually mean like, who was the President Jefferson, who had the copy of the Bible, where he cut out all the verses he didn't like?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was Jefferson, right? Yeah, he had like this Bible where like anything that he didn't like, he would just sort of like, you know, take a little blade and like cut that part out.
He didn't have white out.
No. No. Hadn't been in, no, Michael Nesmith's mother invented
it.
That's right. Yes. Bet you didn't. Now, see, how many synagogues would you walk away from learning that piece of
trivia?
That's
what my takeaway.
That's your takeaway. That one of the monkeys, did not need to make a salary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And no, on the other side of the page, what's he cut out?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's one of those problems. When you start messing around with the text. Anyway, so Kaplan never meant that you should start cutting passages out of the Torah and restitch the columns in the Torah book, right? He meant the concepts. And you can read the whole thing there on your own, and the page numbers are there if you want to look up the larger discussion. And then just to give you an overture to where this middle position is going to emerge, so this is the 1976 Reform Rabbis Centennial Platform. It wasn't, by the way, like it is the United States bicentennial, 1976. Yeah. But the centennial meant it was the centennial of the founding of the Reform movement. Anyway, they said there, Torah results from the relationship between God and the Jewish people. The records of our earliest confrontations, that's an odd word, are uniquely important to us. Lawgivers and prophets, historians and poets gave us a heritage whose study is a religious imperative, and whose practice is our chief means to holiness. Rabbis and teachers, philosophers and mystics, gifted Jews in every age, amplified the Torah tradition. For millennia, the creation of Torah has not ceased, and Jewish creativity in our time is adding to the chain of tradition. And what they're brushing up against there is the term the Reform movement used a lot and still uses residually, called ongoing revelation. So in the Reform movement, it's pretty much a doctrinal consensus, which doesn't mean most Reform Jews know it, but at least among the leadership, that the concept of revelation is foundational to Judaism, that we are modern, so we don't think the entire Torah is literally revealed, but we retain the idea that there is a God who's separate from us, who first encountered the Jewish people, I like that better than confronted, at Mount Sinai. And it's the reality of that encounter rather than the record of the accuracy of that encounter that's significant. Okay, I want to be careful with that. The reality and the faith in the reality of that encounter, that there really is a God who showed up at Sinai and covenanted with the Jewish people, even though the Torah story about it is not historically accurate, is what's really significant. It's for the Reform movement, for which Judaism is still primarily more a sense of religion, meaning a statement of belief, than for the Reconstructionist movement, for who it's more of a culture in which religion is a piece, but it's not the only piece. In the Reform movement, it's really much more important to retain some sense of divine revelation. But to be modern, you have to have ongoing revelation. So here's a commercial for this weekend, or maybe next weekend at your synagogue, based on what your rabbi told me in email yesterday. So I sent her something that I wrote a couple of years ago, not just her, although I often send Rabbi Potemkin things, but I came across a Devar Torah that I gave actually at the Beth Hillel Havara in 2001, about Revelation, and I thought, oh, this is pretty good. Holds up well. So you know, I sent it around to a couple of my rabbi friends, and your rabbi said, oh, is this what you're teaching on Thursday night? Because maybe I'll use some of this, you know, in services Friday night or Saturday here at your synagogue. I said, okay, I won't talk about that stuff then. So you got to come and see if she uses it, right? But the issue that was involved there has to do with the old debate in Jewish tradition, which I'll leave it to Rabbi Potemkin to explain in her way to you guys, as to whether the further back you go, the closer you are to Revelation, and therefore the more accurate, and by extension, flip it over, the further away you get, the further away you are from the transmission, and therefore the less accurate. It's kind of like listening to 1010 Winds on your AM radio in Philadelphia from New York. I grew up with 1010 Winds. I still use it for traffic when I drive north of Trenton. And, you know, in the right place in Philadelphia, you can get 1010 Winds totally clearly. You might as well be in New York. It's unbelievable. And in the wrong place, you can't get anything. And in between, you get a broken signal. And that same metaphor is used by the tradition. And this is part of the Orthodox argument. The earliest stuff is the most reliable because it's closest to the revelation. The further away you get and the further down the generational line the teachers are, you have decay. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Mr. Down the Lane.
Say again?
Mr. Down the Lane.
Yeah, yeah. That's the popular version of that, yeah. It's called in Hebrew, in the rabbinic tradition, Yeridat HaDorot, the decline of the generations. Mm-hmm. You know the word Yerida from modern Israeli state? It's like Israelis who stay in Israel. Say about Israelis who leave Israel that they've gone in Yerida, they've gone down.
As opposed to Aliyah.
Aliyah is you go up. Yeah, yeah. It's a pejorative. The Reform movement is going to make the opposite argument. Yeah, and Linda may talk about this Friday night or Saturday.
It's okay to hear it more than once.
It's okay. I just don't want to preempt whatever she might want to do. And it also will take us a little bit far afield. I don't want to go that far in that direction because it's really its own topic. But I want you to understand why the Reform movement is so concerned about it. Because they take the position that, no, the most recent is the most reliable. Because the most recent has the benefit of historical analysis, academic study, cross-cultural conversation, archaeological discovery, neuroscience. I mean, you know, philosophy, psychology, sociology, anthropology, economics. Everything that we use to understand the evolution of cultures. Right? I mean, it's like at our fingertips, right? You just go online and you just Google all this stuff, right? And you get all this information about this stuff. So we are, not to disparage our ancestors, they knew the best they could know with the tools that they had, but we have so much more data, information, scholarship, and research at our fingertips. So where we are is a more reliable understanding. Mm-hmm. Because we have better tools with which to understand than they had back then. So it's actually the reverse of the decline of the generations. It's the ascent of the generations. Right? Yes?
So for the Reform, ongoing revelation is like revelation because of better tools as opposed to, say, revelation because of the Pentecost or the Holy Spirit or the Shekinah.
Well, it depends, I think, on whether you're reading the academic Reform movement or, as I'm doing this here, working on a Reform synagogue, the current Reform prayer book. You know, what movements say in their prayer books is really remarkable. Remarkably inconsistent, by the way. But really kind of remarkable. They tend to be assertions rather than arguments. And they kind of are a little bit efflorescent. You know, I have a kind of personal intuitive bad reaction to declarations of things that are sort of stated as if everyone knows they're true. Mm-hmm. The Reform prayer book still got a lot of that stuff, and they will tend to like throw off things like, and revelation is not limited to the Jewish people. Revelation has been vouchsafed to peoples and poets and of all nations. They just sort of like throw that in there, and that's a really challenging issue because that's, of course, you know, what Christians say. Yeah, revelation came to us too. In fact, it displaced your revelation.
Yeah, that's
the problem. So, you
know, yeah, that's what it gets
problem. Or Christianity has said that traditionally. I don't want to say all Christians say that.
Is that revelation in the generic term?
Yeah.
Not just from God, but just, well, so why wouldn't that be true? I mean, it sounds like it's perfectly valid.
Well, I think that it would depend, I guess, on, well, look at the debate It may not be Laura Schlesinger, but whoever's like chatting on AM radio these days in the afternoons. And the debate about Islam. Is that revelation? No. You say no, but you know, I'm saying the Reform movement in its prayer book sort of puts it out there, right? So that's their attempt to both keep the idea of revelation and also to be universalist. And they don't want to be like ethnocentric or like, you know, it's not just our God, it's like everybody's God. And I'm just saying they're complex issues, aren't they, that you raise here. Anyway, I want to get past this text and get back to the other material, but I just want to get a sense of what an Orthodox summary sounds like, what the kind of Reconstructionist response sounds like. And the Reform thing is an overture to what we're going to look at mostly in more detail tonight and next week, which is how do people maneuver in that middle zone where give us something that's connected to God, even if it's not literal and verbatim, but don't take that language away entirely, but don't give us orthodoxy. Right? So you're kind of like floating in that middle zone there. It makes it a very interesting time, by the way, to be Jewish. You know, I mean, I've said this to you before when you've been here for other years. It's a remarkably rich moment in Jewish history, spiritually and intellectually, in which we live, where so much that was foundational and fundamental and was challenged in the modern period is sort of open for discussion. With the addition that the assumptions of the modern period that, well, we've solved all those problems, here's the modern answer to them, the modern answers are now open to challenge and rethinking and reevaluation. So, you know, the pendulum swings in different ways and then tends to sort of settle towards the middle. Okay, anything here you guys want to bring up?
I was just thinking that Brett. Underlying this seems to be a conflict between like an intellectual search for the divine and a faith-based search for the divine that seems to kind of underlie like these different perspectives. And I mean, how much you can merge those things seems difficult. Like, can you have like a half faith, half intellectual, or are they somewhat separate realms?
Yeah, it's an interesting way of framing it. I think I would frame it slightly differently. I don't know if this is helpful, and it may not be a response to what you've raised, so feel free to come back and say, but that's not what I was asking. I think it's not a question of whether you come at the tradition with an intellectual set of apperceptive tools. Most Orthodox Jews that I know, frankly, you know, are more involved in this text stuff than the most liberal Jews are. And certainly the Orthodox rabbis that I read, follow, and learn from on a regular basis, either in print, online, or in person, are as intellectually adept as I am, and probably, you know, more so in most cases, frankly. What's different is the presumptive boundaries within which that conversation takes place. And it's an analogy I've used before with you about the Reconstructionist approach, about working within the bounds of tradition when possible, but being willing to step over them and outside when necessary. Understanding the possible and necessary are subjective terms. I've said that every time I've mentioned that here, because I say that all the time. I get that, well, that's not necessary to me, and that's necessary to you. But my Orthodox friends, you know, they can push the walls of the tradition fairly far. They can't push them so far as to say that the Torah is not a unified document that has its source in the revelation of God to Moses at Sinai. I mean, I've got some Orthodox friends and Orthodox rabbi friends who will say what I just said, has its source in. It's pretty liberal for an Orthodox Jew, as opposed to his word for word identical with. But they don't, that's like a foundational position for them. So I think it's not so much the intellectual piece as it is a sense of what's the starting point, and where are you having the conversation? I don't know if that's a response to what you're raising.
I mean, I think it was kind of clarifying for me as you're talking about. I feel like it's maybe like fundamentally about like how do you perceive a relationship with God? Do you fundamentally think of that as like an intellectual relationship or kind of emotional, an emotional relationship?
Yeah, and it's really interesting because you know modern Jews come at that in very different ways. So like the intellectual piece for me has always felt like emotionally resonant, especially when I'm studying the parts of the tradition that you know, I particularly enjoy, which is like Bible. Like I'm a Bible person, not so much like a Talmud person. But I also really like the spiritual stuff that happens when I'm in synagogue, or not in synagogue. And for other people, it's sometimes one or the other. My sense of modern Jews who are not Orthodox is that their conversations around faith don't happen around the conversation around Torah. The parallel conversations, but they don't really influence each other very strongly. Because most of the conversations around faith that I think modern Jews have tend to be spiritual, pastoral types of conversations, not authority, commandment types of conversations. You know, which is why Jews have basically subordinated, you know, the Hebrew name of God to G-O-D. Right? Very few Jews that I know pray to Adonai outside of the Reformed Prayer Book, right? Which uses that in all of its English, praised are you Adonai, our God, so on and so on. But when people spontaneously pray, in my experience, they use the word God. I'm not saying that critically, I'm saying that as an observation. Mm-hmm. And I think they tend to think about, you know, things like health, illness, war, train crashes, to speak of, you know, what's been going on this week. You know, those kind of things that call into question our place in the universe. Is there an order to the universe? Is there a right and wrong in the universe? Morality is another area, you know, where that often comes up, certainly in public conversation, not just on talk radio. Happens at NPR also. Not with Laura Schlesinger, by the way. In which case, I'm taking back my pledge if it is. So, I mean, I think we'll see it kind of emerge as we go through. I think for the earlier generations, I mean like the 1800s, early 1900s, it was more of an intellectual exercise, which is why they tended to use the word God concept or God idea instead of God. So the early reform statements, you know, 1880s, 1930s, will say, you know, Judaism has the such and such God idea. Kaplan, by the way, same thing. Judaism is civilization. You know, the God idea, the God idea, the God idea, the God. Where's God? You know, it's an idea. He didn't mean something pejorative by it. He meant it's something you can think about and contemplate, but it's not something you interact with, because it's not a person. For him, it's not a personality. Anyway, I want to go to this handout, the one that is that says Eight Chaim Conservative JPS in my handwriting in the circle. So I give this to folks who were here last week and said, if you had the time and you had the energy and the interest, you could read through. But I underlined the parts I wanted to touch on with you, but I still encourage you to read this. And as I mentioned last week, just to underscore for your friends who are conservative, these essays, which are going to point to the same historical academic perspective as Reconstructionists, that the Torah seems to have a literary history of multivocalism, and to have emerged over a period of time, is found in the back of the current conservative Pentateuch that's used in conservative synagogues. So even though conservative Jews often sitting in the pews will think that their movement teaches that the Torah is from God, the book that their movement puts out that's sitting in the pews in their sanctuary doesn't say that. Okay? So it's helpful to know that. Anyway, this essay by Daniel Gordas and the other one by, I just lost his name, Elliot. Elliot Dorff, yes. So many Elliots in the conservative movement. Are really just excellent summaries. So we're moving from primary sources to secondary sources here. So these are people talking about what other people say. I could have Xeroxed the primary sources for you, and we could have plowed through them, and we'll look at some of them this week and next week. But I thought that the secondary source was actually a much easier text for us to work with. This comes across much clearer. So just sticking with the underlines for now, but please stop me if you want to stop at some point, because I want to try to cover as much as we can tonight by 9 o'clock. Are we okay? Mm-hmm. Till 9? If we started, if we called it for 7:15 and started at 7:30, what time are we supposed to end?
We end between 9 and 9:15.
Okay.
We start thinking about ending by 9, but I know us, and so we should be really done by 9:15.
Well, I was going to say, I know us, and usually around 9 o'clock is when we start to lose people.
Right.
So let's...
And then someone asks an amazing question, so feel free to do that.
That's right. Okay. So you see, Mary and I differ on the interpretation of what 9 o'clock means. We'll see which one of us is the Torah of the Lord. Okay.
The tape runs out.
All right, so here's Daniel Gordas. And just reading the underlines. This is biblical and rabbinic, okay? That's biblical and rabbinic. That's about 1,500 years. We're about to cover it in about 15 minutes. So stay with us here, but stop me if I'm going too fast. Revelation, the claim that God has spoken to mortals and made known to them truths about the world and its nature, is central to Jewish belief. No argument. Continuing with the underlines, the Torah does not specify precisely what was revealed to Moses. We saw that last week. Much of rabbinic tradition asserts that the entire Torah, understood as including the rabbinic oral tradition as well as the Torah's written tradition, we'll come back to that in a moment, had been revealed by God to Moses at Sinai, although the Torah never states that explicitly. Okay? It is true. I mean, you saw that last week. Exodus 20 suggests that the entire content of the revelation might well have been only the Ten Commandments, the Ten Statements. Although Rashi and many other commentators, Rashi's, 1100s, understand the Torah as indicating that many more laws were also revealed at Sinai. Okay? So is this on your sheet? Does your sheet say written Torah, Torah Shebiktav?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Because I don't often remember whether I wrote it on yours or mine also. So just to be clear here, there's two traditions in rabbinic Judaism. The Bible doesn't know about this either. Of what revelation is. There's the written Torah and the oral Torah. Mm-hmm. The oral Torah is an invention of the rabbinic period. Yeah. The rabbis who invented it don't think they invented it. Okay? They think they inherited it. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they thought that self-consciously or they had a total absence of self-consciousness, mm-hmm. I'm going to leave as a side conversation for another time. It was the assumption of the modern Jewish period, the 20th century, that they were kind of benighted and just not really sophisticated enough to realize that they were inventing something and to call it for what it was. Kaplan, by the way, pretty much holds that position. He sort of like looks down on them as, yeah, they were smart, but they weren't really that smart. postmodern Jewish scholars tend to have a little more respect for them and say, they know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. They know God didn't command anyone to light Hanukkah candles. And they still made up a blessing that said, Asher Kodeshana B'mitzvotav, to light the Hanukkah candles. They're not stupid. They know what's going on, okay? Anyway, the oral Torah and the written Torah come to be part of what our tradition understands the revelation to have been. And so that becomes not just the Torah scroll, but also Jewish law, halakha, is understood to be the revelation of God. So, it may say in Deuteronomy, you shall bind them as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. That means tefillin, say the rabbis. How do you know? Because it's in the oral law. And the oral law also comes from Sinai. Right? So Moses wore tefillin, according to many of the rabbis. According to academics, probably not. Like, hadn't been invented yet. Doesn't mean the amulets weren't worn, by the way. That's a whole different discussion. But for the rabbinic position, you should be writing these all down. It's next year's adult ed choices. Right? for the rabbinic tradition, that's all rolled into one package. Written Torah, oral Torah, okay? So that's what they're suggesting here. Let's go on to the next page, which will be page 1395. I didn't bother to renumber these pages. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay? These pages have numbers. Fortunately, I didn't Xerox 1,393 prior pages for you. Can buy the book. Just the underlines here. It is striking that the Torah seems more concerned that the people Israel accept the notion that revelation took place than that they reach any certainty about the content of that revelation.
God, that's
conservative.
So true.
Guy, did you say?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In the same way, by the way, in the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Israel, Hino Adonai Echad, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord. The word Echad there probably means alone in the book of Deuteronomy, which is where it's originally found, because there it's a pledge of allegiance. It doesn't mean Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, which is what all the prayer books translated as later on. Mm-hmm. See, I'm teaching that course on Tuesday nights, the same 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. At Mainline Reform, we're doing the history of the Shema, which I think I did here at one point, I can't remember. And with you guys, I'm doing the history of Revelation. I'm trying not to have these things totally cross in my mind. But there, you know, we just read Tuesday night a traditional understanding of liturgy that you don't have to understand what you say when you say the Shema word for word, as long as you have the general sense of what it's about. That's a traditional teaching that's found, you know, in rabbinic sources. Similarly here, the Torah seems more concerned that the concept of revelation have certainty than the content of that revelation. So that's really interesting. Verbal communication from God to human beings, I'm just reading the underlines, is an essential component of biblical revelation at Sinai. That's again the issue of speaking versus reading. Right? Really interesting question. You know, because as Rabbi Potemkin once said, it's not like when Moses came down from Sinai, he said, please turn to page 200 in the Herz Chumash. Right? I don't remember when she said it. It was a great line, though, when she said that. They didn't have the Herz Chumash. Right? They didn't have a Chumash. And it's like Moses came down and said, here's a gift certificate to Amazon. You know, everyone go sign on and order your copy of the Torah. It's not like they didn't have that. It was an oral tradition in any event.
Right? Which is really important for it to be able to remain multivocal.
That's nice. Yes. Yes.
That it's oral and not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's O-R-A-L and A-U-R-A-L, by the way, which is also something interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. It's both an oral and an oral tradition, which means it's dynamic. Yeah. It's relational, which is what the Reform quotation that we read earlier pointed to. Torah emerges from the relationship between God and the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Someone speaks, someone hears. Someone responds. Someone responds. It's conversational. It's a good sermon. Wait, I'm going to this.
When you say aural, you're meaning you hear it. You're not speaking. It sounds like you're saying aural.
A-U-R, as I was trying to say, A-U-R-A-L is up here.
But
aural
means like
aural.
Around the body.
That's aura.
But the adjective of that would be aural.
Is there? I wasn't aware of that.
Maybe the same spelling.
I think it's a different spelling. I'm just seeing it. Sounds the same, but it's two different words.
No, there's
no.
It's something else.
No, I didn't know. No, so what I meant. So thank you for the clarification.
But
is,
I think the
other word auditory. Auditory, maybe is an easier word.
The other word applies also, I think, in an interesting way with the multivocal.
Yeah, it could. Yeah.
So if that's the kind of clear relationship or the way it was transmitted, why is it thought that the rabbis invented the idea of oral Torah if the Torah was oral? I mean, there seems to be kind of a contradiction there.
Well, the curious thing that they're getting to is that the written Torah is originally an oral Torah. I think that's what they're pointing to. But in the bifurcation of later rabbinic tradition, rabbinic tradition after the Bible period, the Torah that's spoken at Sinai becomes a Torah that's written in the scroll. And therefore it becomes fixed, the way that anything is once you write it down and you close it off. Now you can only interpret it or expand it. You can't change it.
Right.
I mean, it is what it is. So there's a move from, I think, the hearing piece, although it's still relational.
Yeah.
Right? When the Torah is read on Saturday morning, it's meant to be heard in some way. Certainly on Shavuot it's meant to be heard that way. As if you are receiving it, not as if you are reading it. Mm-hmm. And that's just an interesting kavanah, like for us to think about, you know? Like when people go to meditation, you know, for example, they very often, you know, some people, you know, they immediately like do this with their hands. Now you go to yoga, this happens a lot also if you go to the right yoga studio. People assume a posture of receiving. And it's interesting that we don't do that very much in terms of Torah. Choreography. We do like point or raise the fringe, you know, when the Torah is lifted or something like that. But we don't do this piece so much. And I just sometimes wonder where that choreography piece is of like receiving Torah. Right? Because that's the same dynamic that the Torah will... I'm going to come back to your question in a minute. I did see you raise your hand, so just so you know, I didn't miss you. The debate in tradition between Matan Torah, the giving of Torah, and Kabbalat Torah, the receiving of Torah, is that same dynamic problem. Giving or receiving? Giving or receiving? And, you know, you could almost say that some Jews are giving Jews and some Jews are receiving Jews. For some Jews, it's essential that what we have was given to us, and for other Jews, what's essential is that we receive it. Mm-hmm. By the way, they're not mutually exclusive and they're not meant to be. Right? They're certainly not meant to be. And I wouldn't, by the way, make that an Orthodox, you know, Reconstructionist thing at all. Because there's a lot of Orthodox authorities who say, you know, the real mitzvah of Torah is receiving it, not believing it was given. Because that's the loyalty piece. That's the behavioral response to God's, you know, making the covenant. I'm sorry, you're very patient. Go ahead.
I was just reacting to the idea here stated that the Torah seems more concerned that the people, Israel, accept the idea that revelation took place than that they reach any certainty about the content.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what metaphor I've been playing with helps me think about that, because if you think of Shavuot and the giving of Torah as a marriage,
mm-hmm.
if you think about two people getting married, the most important thing is that they show up at a certain time, a certain place,
mm-hmm.
and they get,
mm.
you know, they sign the ketubah. Is it as important that they understand every little article in the ketubah?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can go back later and figure that
mm-hmm.
out, or
mm-hmm.
argue about it later, or rejoice over it. But the fact that you're married is the key, rather than the details.
Once the Jews get out of the ghetto and are able to use civil law in the Western European countries and then in North America by extension, things like the legal nature of a ketubah become less significant. But when that was their only system, the legal stuff, I was thinking when you gave the analogy that it's like, do you have to understand everything that's in the paperwork you sign when you buy or sell a house?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer to that, by and large, is you don't need to, but your attorney does, right? Because if there's stuff in there that's prejudicial or injurious to you, you need to know that because you're going to be held accountable for it. And they can say, well, I didn't know that. And I said, well, you signed it, right?
So is Moses the attorney?
No, as I said last week, you've got, you know, the right overture. When I pointed out to you in Exodus 19, Moses led the people towards the mountain is understood by later Jewish mysticism to be like the father of the bride, bringing the bride to the chuppah.
Who really does read the ketubah in detail.
Yes, yes, yes. And interestingly, just to run this metaphor or analogy out a little bit, in certain pre-modern cultures and certain contemporary cultures, it will be the great benefit of the bride to say, I don't know what, but I trust that you do. Because you're my father and you wouldn't be marrying me off to this person if you hadn't read all the stuff in the fine print that I don't understand. So it's almost like the Jewish people say to Moses, like, we don't quite get all this, so as long as you get this, that's okay. And it's a kind of interesting insight, right? But Jewish mysticism, you know, which is also multivocal. I got to be really careful about this. This isn't one Jewish mysticism either. But a large piece of Jewish mysticism is going to run with that metaphor, that Shavuot is the wedding, you know, that the Torah is the ketubah of the Jewish people with God. And
Push it a little further. Passover, the first Passover, and the parting of the Red Sea, that was a date. That was a real getting to know you. And can we make this work? And the answer apparently was yes.
I'm just imagining Moses on the night of the last plague saying, I'll pick you up at midnight. And Pharaoh saying, that's fine, you better have him back in 3 days. Well, that's what he says, right? Moses says, look, we'll just go 3 days out into the desert. We're just going out 3 days.
Cool,
you know? Yeah, we're going camping for the holiday weekend.
Well, it's like you're buying into the essence, like that you're accepting this God, whatever God character, God
mm-hmm.
thought, whatever. You're accepting it. Forget the details. This is what you're accepting as part of your life. Just like you were asking before about the Ten Commandments, does everything have to be written down, like all the rules that you follow? There's so much more between the lines than 10 rules. I mean, there are so many subtleties. You could never enumerate every single thing that you have to do.
Right, and that's one of the classical arguments of rabbinic tradition for the authenticity of the oral law. Because if God just said observe the Sabbath and didn't tell you how, it wouldn't do you any good to know to observe the Sabbath. So of course all those rules that emerge in the oral law and in the halakha, they have to be from God also, because it wouldn't be very nice of God to tell you. It's like telling your kids, be a decent person. Well, how exactly do we do that?
You show them. Right. So it's almost, it's visual? I don't know. It's not written, it's not oral. It's just a sensual thing in the sense that they're observing and they're taking in your behavior. And that's how you teach. And that's throughout the Bible, too.
Yeah, that's why it seems, that marriage metaphor seems really powerful, because it's like what you don't know. I mean, it's like love. I mean, you don't, when you get married, it's like you know you love the person in an intellectual, I know every detail, so I love them. I mean, you come to love them through experience. I mean, I think that seems like it could be a way of thinking.
Relationship.
Yeah. Well, the relationship piece is just something to keep track of, because it keeps the idea of Torah as something dynamic and not static sort of in front of us, which is a good thing, I think, for us to track.
Okay, there's a statement on the second page of this handout that God communicates the sense of the plan of history. To Abraham, for example, God states, I will assign this land to your offspring. Now, to which offspring, and how is that interpreted? People can interpret that in various ways.
Well, this is where, as a Reconstructionist, I would depart a little from the article that I gave you here, because I would have to reframe this. And he goes right into, there are moments when God communicates messages. For example, God says to Abraham, and of course, as a Reconstructionist, my sense is, the people who wrote the story said that God said to Abraham. And that's the quirky little Reconstructionist moment in studying Bible that always makes it, to me, more challenging, but also more accessible. Because I don't know when that text was written. We've done this so many other times in the previous years. Just because Genesis comes before Exodus doesn't mean Genesis was written before Exodus. Right? We just have no idea. So what's more interesting to me, I think the way Mordecai Kaplan phrases it, it's really interesting, and the rabbis know this, by the way, right away, because they have the Torah memorized. So they can tell you every place a certain word appears. They're great at that. I mean, now you just Google that. You just have to look it up in a concordance. But they knew that stuff by heart. And what's interesting, I mean, a different way of asking the question is, when the Torah says God says X about the land, how many times does God say X? How many times does God say Y? How many times does God say, and what's similar and what's different? Right? Like in this week's, the first of the two Torah portions this week, where God says, for the land is mine and you are resident aliens with me. Right? Raises the whole question of whether the land itself is holy, or it's only holy because God says it's holy, or is it holy because it's God's land, or is it holy because it's where the Jewish people are supposed to live out God's plan? Is the actual earth sacred? I mean, that's kind of far from where most Jewish theology would be. But the Torah says. So, that's where I would have to take a little bit of a step away from some of the language of the essay. Okay? Now, I'm going to skip a little bit of this stuff just because of time, because I do want to get to the rabbinic tradition. And so if you go over just one page, this is 1396, which is just underlined in the bottom right-hand corner. The sentence starts, the paragraph starts ultimately the Torah's instructions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the whole discussion before that, which we're not reading tonight, but you can read on your own, is the debate in Deuteronomy 13 and Deuteronomy 18 about how do you know if someone shows up and says, I'm a prophet and God said, whether they're really a prophet and whether you have to pay attention to them. Torah doesn't give you any information here that's the least bit helpful, by the way. You know, one position is, if what they said comes true, then they were a true prophet. That's not so helpful if you're trying to decide, do we fight the Babylonians or submit to the Babylonians, right? Well, we'll see what you're... So that's part of the problems with prophecy. You know, it's almost always an after-the-fact designation. Mm-hmm. In their own lifetime, most prophets are contested. You know? Anyway, what I wanted to pick up here is just the next line, but I just wanted you to know what they were referring to in the earlier discussion on the same page. But starting with the underline and then going on to the next page, because the Torah itself acknowledges that God's revelations do not address all possible situations, any more than the Constitution does, and that it would be difficult to determine with, next page, 1397, with certainty in the future whose guidance to follow, it's not surprising that a radically new model of revelation would emerge as tradition developed. The new model of revelation was the product of the scholars of the rabbinic period, although it begins as early as Ezra. So Ezra, again, just as an easy mnemonic, is 444 BCE. It doesn't mean it's exactly 444, by the way, but it's sometime around the 440s, 450s, so 444 is easy to remember. Most modern scholars agree the Torah began to be available as a written document. Now, there's really soft language. Yeah. Approximately during the lifetime of Ezra, who may well have initiated the practice of reading the Torah in public, which I mentioned to you last week. You can look up in the book of Nehemiah at the end of the Bible, chapter 8, verse 8. I don't have the Bible memorized. I just know that one, so don't be impressed. I just happen to know that one. But that's where there's a narrative of Ezra reading the Bible, the Torah rather, what appears to be the Torah, to an assembly in Jerusalem, from which a lot of our choreography emerges, by the way, of lifting the Torah, of saying the blessing before and after. You'll see that all the way back then, which is where a lot of the rabbinic tradition seems to get it from, okay? Just skipping down to the underline, then we'll come back for a moment. Over the course of time, the scribes or Pharisees, subsequently the sages, developed a rich, complex legal and moral tradition to amplify the Torah. In due course, rabbinic tradition began to speak in terms of both a written Torah, the five books of Moses, and an oral Torah, the tradition of explication and interpretation of the written Torah, compiled over many centuries. These rabbis considered the oral Torah to be as authoritative as the written Torah because they held that both had been received by Moses from God at Sinai. Okay? So the basic issue that's being discussed in this part of the essay is that once the Torah is a static document, interpreting it, expanding it, responding to things that it didn't anticipate, can't really be governed by prophecy. Prophecy is not a reliable medium through which to innovate or interpret, because it is very hard to pin down, and it's not communal, it's individual. The oral tradition, which is the rabbis debate, discuss, and decide, is not necessarily always a democratic process, but it's a collective process. It's a conversational process. And so just like the Supreme Court interprets definitively, for better or worse, what the Constitution means as they understand it in response to a contemporary issue that the Constitution probably didn't anticipate or did not clarify, right? The rabbinic tradition of oral Torah does the same thing functionally in Jewish tradition. And when modern Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism say we are no longer bound by Jewish law and the oral Torah and halakha, it may influence us, but we are not bound by it. They have taken away that prop of who decides and who determines and decentralized it. And by the way, movements still do that. They make platforms, they make positions, like, you know, the Reformer Reconstructionist movement have ambilineal identity for Jewish kids if one parent's Jewish and the other one isn't, and so on and so on. I mean, movements do take positions around things like that. But they tend to do them like at conventions, you know, by raising your hand and things like that. It's not done, you know, in the classical way of Jewish law. And, you know, American culture is a kind of interesting parallel example. You know, the populist version is, why is the Supreme Court deciding, you know, whether gay marriage is okay? You know, we should all be voting on that. And then you get the other position, or at least all the states should be voting individually, right? Not all the states voting collectively. So this idea of like populist participation is also kind of confusing. Anyway, so this is what's called the Oral Torah in Hebrew. I wrote here in the margin, bless you. Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Torah that is of spoken nature. Okay? As opposed to Torah Shebichtav, which is the written Torah. Okay? So at the bottom of that same column, the rabbis declared that after the destruction of the first temple of 586 BCE by the Babylonians, revelation would no longer be transmitted through prophets. Continuing with the underline, from the day the temple was destroyed, prophecy was taken from the prophets and given to the sages. So say the sages. Well, you know, everything's got a little bit of a political dimension to it, right? You know, the beginning of Pirkei Avot, right, the ethics of the ancestors that you read from Passover to Shavuot, traditionally. The first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot is Moshe Kibel Torah Misanei Amisaruha LeYehoshua, the Yerusha Zekanim, Zekanim Lachik, and Asagodala. That Moses got the Torah at Sinai, gave it to Joshua, who's not mentioned in Exodus 19, and they gave it to the elders, who gave it to the men of the great assembly, gave it to the prophets, who gave it to the elders, who gave it to the men of the great assembly, who happened to be the antecedents of the rabbis. Right? So it's a really self-serving introduction to Pirkei Avot. It basically says, you know, we're here to tell you what Jewish law is. And that's why people like Jacob Neusner, you know, the great rabbinic scholar, thinks that Pirkei Avot originally was the introduction to the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. Now it occurs, don't hold me to this, in the fourth or fifth tractate, I cannot remember. It's clearly out of place. Where it is in the Mishnah, I think in the fourth order or the fifth order, it doesn't fit. But it would have been a great introduction and overture to the entire Mishnah. Because mm-hmm. it's all about establishing the authority of the rabbis who are about to teach you the Mishnah. Because mm-hmm. if you don't accept the authority of the people who are teaching it, who cares what the Mishnah says, right? So this is the nice tradition that prophecy was taken from the prophets and given to the sages. The next underline tells you the other tradition, which is on the next page of the Talmud. By the way, BTBB, you didn't ask what that was? Babylonian Talmud is BT. Mm-hmm. BB is the tractate Bava Batra. Mm-hmm. There's like three gates, Bava Batra, Bava Mitzi, and Bava Kama. The first gate, the middle gate, the big gate, the middle gate, the little gate. Not to be confused with Bava Maisa. As some of you know, is a different tradition, right? It is folktale, right? Which is a different word altogether. But on the next page, it says, from the day the temple was destroyed, prophecy was taken away from the prophets and given to fools and children. That's the other tradition, right? Which is interesting, by the way, because it doesn't mean that children are fools.
Yeah.
I think what they're pointing to is those are not people whose opinion is taken as seriously definitive.
As gospel.
Or as gospel. but you know, as Art Linkletter said, if you remember Art Linkletter, you know, kids say what? Kids say the darndest things, right? Kids say the darndest thing. And sometimes, you know, kids will say something that's really profound. Right? You know, Sandy Sasso has done all that work on the spirituality of children. And so has Robert Coles and a number of other people. Another digression, but it's just interesting to note. Anyway, so what you get here is, what I hope you get here is there's a polemic against prophecy. Mm-hmm. And it's replaced by an appeal to authority as vested in the teachers who become the sages, become the rabbis. So prophecy gets displaced, as I said to you last week, probably for the reason that once Ezra codifies the Torah, you really don't want people standing on the corner saying, "Thus says the Lord." Right? It's like if the Constitution was promulgated and it was subject to reinterpretation by every person who wanted to say, "But here's what it now means," you wouldn't have a system. Right? You lose a system once any individual can challenge the meaning of an established text. So prophecy yields, I think, because it's untenable. Once you've got a defined text, it's really an untenable intrusion on the stability of the system to have people claiming to speak on behalf of God when the text is what God said. God said what God wanted to say in the text. We don't need you to tell us. Thanks very much. Okay. So at the bottom of this page, modern Jews who are at home with the notion that most cultures evolve over time and that interpretation and development are essential for the vitality of any intellectual tradition. It's important to understand that the sages were making a very different claim. They presented themselves simply as a new vessel for the transmission of that which had been revealed by God long ago. For them, the entire tradition was a single, seamless entity. I think they mean by that, to go back, Brad, to the question you raised about the intellectual piece, that the system overrides individual interpretation. It doesn't mean they didn't see seams. They saw inconsistencies, and they knew that they were making laws, and they knew that they were, you know, in many cases, turning the Torah on its head. And a classical example is, you know, Rabbi Hillel invents in the late first century, early second century, this legal economic fiction that allows people's loans in the sixth year or the 49th year of the Shemitah year or the Jubilee year not to be dismissed but to be held by a third party so that the person who's making the loan doesn't lose their capital. The loan is not wiped out, it's reassigned. Mm. Now, the Torah really does not make a provision for that. In fact, Deuteronomy is at pains that you should keep lending to people even in the sixth year because they knew people would say, wait, I'm going to give you money? You know, it's like giving to someone who's going to predict the end of the world next week like a 30-year mortgage. You know, I mean, what's the point, right? Unless you don't think that there's going to be the end of the world, in which case you're happy to give somebody a 30-year mortgage. So when Hillel did that, you know, one of the questions you would want to ask Mordecai Kaplan, do you really think Hillel didn't know he was turning the Torah inside out when he made that provision? Of course he knew he was turning the Torah inside out. But he found a way to do it that made him think that we have discovered what the Torah really meant to teach, not we have turned the Torah inside out. And that's one of the great traditions of Jewish tradition. You know, we have discovered that the Torah all along really meant this. We, you know, it's like the Supreme Court. We have, what are they called? We're not activists. It's like original intent in the Supreme Court conversation. I think that's what Gord is trying to suggest here, that for the rabbis of the Talmud, not in a polemical sense, but in a conceptual sense, the intellectual piece, they understood what they were doing to be in original intent. This is what it was intended to mean all along. And either we've just discovered it or we're restoring it.
Yeah. I mean, but doesn't this overlook like that there's an acceptance that there is no unified truth? I mean, it seems to me like really evident in the Talmud that it's not like the sages have a singular viewpoint. There's a continual contradiction. So it's like I don't know if you can say like Hillel thinks he's overturned the Torah. It's more just he understands that he's like part of this multivocal contradiction that is somehow still truth. So it's like you don't have to say like my truth is the one truth.
Yeah, I think again like conceptually my sense is that they've moved away, if they were ever there, by the way. I think truth is much more of a contemporary conversation than it was for the rabbinic and the biblical tradition, honestly. I mean, it may be something that's going on very actively in Greek philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's not a big part of the Bible conversation. I mean, the concept of truth in that sense. It's not irrelevant. But the concept of law is more important, I think, certainly to the rabbis than the concept of truth. So at the end of the day, Hillel's got to get to how we're going to interpret the law so that the society and the economy can function in a way that's not discriminatory against people who are 47, whatever the X percent are, not the 1%.
The 97%.
Yeah. And I think the question of truth for them, it kind of yields to the question of law, which is where the caricature later emerges in the polemics of Christianity and Judaism, that we're a tradition of legalism and Christianity is a tradition of spirituality. I mean, we've got spirituality and they've got legalism. Right? I mean, you ever look at the criteria for naming somebody a saint in the Catholic Church? I mean, it could come out of the Talmud. You know, it's as legalistic as anything that we've got. So every system has those things. I mean, that's part, again, like part of the late 20th and 21st century discovery that these old binaries of they're like this and we're like that, as opposed to we have a piece of that and they've got a piece of that. That's much more the way, like, you know, we look at stuff now.
So if there's that separation between law and truth, like, isn't that somewhat separate from questions of revelation then? I mean, if they really are thinking, okay, you know, this is what I need to do to kind of align law with, they're not saying, yeah. Oh, but the revelation changes because they've made that dichotomy.
Right, well, I think you put your finger on the really big issue. And it was kind of implicit in what we were looking at in the Bible period. which is if this becomes the common assumption of the early rabbinic period, such that it's not even debated or discussed, and it's not actually really established anywhere that I'm aware of. There's conversations, but they're really much more midrashic than they are legalistic. It would at least suggest that one possibility is that the whole doctrine of the revelation at Sinai and of it being the written and the oral law is a working backwards chronologically to explain in contemporary terms why the people and the system that are now in charge are authoritative. Instead of the other way around. In other words, since the Torah and the Bible doesn't make any claim for the veracity of the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses being the word of God, and doesn't know anything about the oral Torah, it's at least plausible to suggest that implicit in the emergence of Jewish law and the authorities governing it and adjudicating it, and recognized as authoritative, is the implicit question of who put you in charge. And so when the Mishnah or in Pirkei Avot starts with, you know, Moses got the Torah, gave it to Joshua, to the prophets, to the elders, that's the answer implicit to that question. But it starts with Moses got the Torah. It doesn't say, you know, the elders received. It takes you all the way back to Moses, the beginning of Pirkei Avot. It's interesting. It doesn't say Abraham, by the way. You mentioned Abraham. It does not say Abraham.
Yeah.
Abraham learned about one God. You know, and then the Jews went down to Egypt, then they had Passover, and then eventually Moses came. It starts with Moses. And that's, again, where the faith-truth thing really becomes subordinate, I think, in rabbinic Judaism. Not irrelevant, but subordinate to the issue of behavior, praxis, and conformity. And behavior, praxis, and conformity is a conservative social strategy for ensuring, or at least encouraging, the continuity of a community that's geographically dispersed, speaks different languages, doesn't live in the homeland. You know, all the things that Jews become in the Second Temple period, you know, from 500 to the beginning of the Common Era. It's an effective tool, and many of you know, if you read The Jew and the Lotus, that, you know, this was the question that Dalai Lama invited, you know, a number of rabbis to come to India and debate back in the late 1980s. You know, like, because he's dealing with the same issue. How do you keep a tradition that's in geographic exile together for a population that doesn't all speak the same language, can't come to the same place, right, and doesn't have, well, it doesn't exactly transfer, as the rabbis tried to explain to the Dalai Lama, but it was the question he was asking. Like, how do you guys do it? Basically, I don't know if that sounds like in Pali, but that's what he asked, basically.
Well, I think this, like, sort of reflects an inherent instability in any form of identity. In other words, any form of social identity, let's say, that, you know, a people coalesces and they consider themselves a people. Who can say when that identity was formed? There's no way to know. It's like saying, do you remember when you became a person? And so there's like this inherent instability where you have to sort of almost create this fiction that says, oh, it started here.
Yeah.
And that's all, and that is inherently problematic because there's power involved.
Well, it's not only problematic, it's potentially really dissonant.
Yeah.
And it's like a solvent. You know, if you apply that insight to a conservative tradition, it dissolves.
Mm.
Right? Which is what modern Jews, especially Orthodox Jews, intuitively understand when they get anxious, as do liberal Jews, when you say God didn't write the Torah. I say that, by the way, you know, in Reconstructionist settings, and I watch people get anxious.
Well,
not because intellectually that they're like unable to process that. They can process that. But because underlying that, you know, is the essential and essential insight of the modern period and the postmodern period, which is that what we take to be necessary is really contingent. And seeing through that is both liberating and a little scary. I mean, my parents aren't right? My parents aren't perfect. They aren't always right. Like, when do kids discover that? Earlier than they used to, apparently. Yeah, but I mean, eventually you discover that. So, like, American exceptionalism, which promises to be, you know, an ugly part of the election conversation, you know, like, we're best because we are. You know, we have the best healthcare because we're America and we're the best country. So therefore, we have to have the best healthcare. I mean, I'm not going to argue the issues with you. This insight, you know, what Neil Gilman, who's like a brilliant conservative Reconstructionist rabbi, called the broken myth. Okay, so I know we're a little after 9 o'clock. I'm just letting you know I know that. Okay, I have about 7 minutes that I can wrap this up in. I'm going to try. Okay, but. You've raised a really important issue, which I just want to digress for a minute. Neil Gilman has this brilliant insight in which he says that when religious traditions hit the modern period, there's really only three options. One is you reassert the myth against all evidence to the contrary. That's Orthodox Judaism in our system, right? Or Protestant evangelical Christianity, the Bible is the word of God. You reject the system because now you know where it really came from. You know, the Jews weren't in Egypt, there weren't 600,000, they were a ragtag group of tribes that kind of like were outliers and sort of like, you know, migrated to the edges of Palestine where the fences weren't so high and eventually, and then they told this phantasmagorical story about 12 tribes and, you know, never happened. In which case, like, you know, so find me some other tradition. You know, I don't need this. Like, forget it. And, you know, there's lots of people who walk away from their religious tradition over that. And then there's what Gilman calls the third option, which is where just about everybody else is, which is re-embracing the broken myth. Yes, the Torah is not from God, and yes, it's still sacred. Well, mm-hmm. That's why you guys are here. If you didn't think that on some level, you wouldn't be at the synagogue. I mean, you'd be someplace, right? But I don't think you'd be so comfortable here. And I wouldn't be able to, you know, have this kind of conversation with you. I mean, I can't teach this stuff in every synagogue because, you know, it's weird for people when rabbis say, like, God didn't give the Torah, except if you're a Reconstructionist rabbi. It's sort of like normal conversation, but, you know, it's still not what people expect to hear people say if the word rabbi is in front of their name. So the broken myth issue, which is you take all the intellectual modern apparatus of science, philosophy, philology, archaeology, everything else, and so, yeah, we have a better sense of where the Jews and the Torah came from. And then you jump that data to embrace it in a relationship that, right? That's what kids do, you know, when they manage to renegotiate their relationship with their parents as they become adolescents and adults. They jump the myth and they accept, like, all right, so you have a history and you're not consistent and, you know, where did you come from anyway and what was your childhood like? I mean, they learn to understand that there's a backstory to what we take as necessary. But implicit in that, you know, is a real challenge. I said this to you guys before at Beth Israel many times, that in a culture where people intuit with varying degrees of comfort that cultures are contingent, there's often an assumption, but religion is stable. And what Mordecai Kaplan said was, and I hate to tell you, but as a social construction, religion is as contingent and diverse and historically conditioned as everything else in a society, language, politics, economics, I mean, you name it. And, you know, personally, that's why I became a Reconstructionist, because he was the only person, and Ira Eisenstein, who said, like, we have to look at Judaism the way we look at everything else in the world. You can't, like, look at religion differently from the way you look at everything else. It's not intellectually honest, or Ira would say truthful, you know, to use the word that Brett mentioned. And I find that just such an important insight. But I also understand why it's really anxiety-producing, because it becomes like the last holdout. You know, it's kind of like if you go to a Buddhist place and, you know, people just want to learn mindfulness to reduce their stress, which is not a bad thing. And then you get one of those teachers who really wants you to realize that there's no sense of self. People say, well, wait a minute, you know. You know, I'm finally sitting here in meditation and doing yoga and, you know, reducing my stress, and I'm really getting into this breathing stuff, but what do you mean there's no sense of self? By the way, I gave you a very probably imprecise rendering of what the Buddhist tradition really means by non-self. So please don't go home and think that that's what Buddhism is. It's not. But that's what people hear, by the way. That's what Westerners hear at a Buddhist retreat center, I can tell you, because I go there, and that's what that's what people get anxious about. You know, in those rare moments in 7 days where they let you talk, you know, and they say to the teacher, well, I have a question about that thing you talked about non-self. What's that non-self thing? You can always tell newbies at a meditation retreat, because that's the first question. Like, what's that non-self thing? I'm not saying that, by the way, pejoratively. Okay, so I've got 1.5 minutes to read the last underline.
I had a comment I just wanted to share.
Go ahead, Celine. Then I'm going to read the last underline really fast.
This, I mean, it kind of relates to whether or not you want to set yourselves apart, or if you want to realize that you are more like other people and become, I don't know, dispersed or more like others. So if you want to say, okay, I'm Jewish and this is what it means and these are my rules and so forth, then you want that differentiation, okay, this is sacred or whatever, but you can also look at, I mean, in so many other ways in the world, people are connecting with other people they have no other connection with because of the internet or phones or sharing things, and they see that there's so much interconnectivity and so much similarity between people.
Sure.
Like with my boyfriend's Protestant, but we see a Presbyterian, and
That's Protestant.
But I don't know. It's all the same.
Protestant's the set. Presbyterian's a subset.
So we see, because, you know, we want to be more connected, we see the similarities between our religions as opposed to the differences. So I guess when people are uncomfortable with you know, the basis, the foundation of your religion, it's because they want to set themselves apart, maybe. That's just my suggestion.
I think the other anxiety that's implicit in that, and this is the question that Brad has raised, is, isn't religion supposed to be about truth, not opinion? So the Jews have an opinion that there's monotheism? That's not really true that there's monotheism?
But isn't truth more complicated than all these dichotomies that we're setting up and breaking down and setting up? I mean, that's not how the world really is.
Correct.
This way or that way.
Correct.
That's not really true either.
No, and I don't mean to suggest that it is. I hope I'm supporting what you're elucidating probably more clearly than I did, which is that, there's this complexity of overdetermination in which you try to explain why anything's the way it is. I mean, who knows? So it's such, you know, it's like single factor analysis in social science went out, you know, in the 60s already. But I think, you know, the question that Celine's pointing to is really important, because it is... it was for someone like Ira Eisenstein the bridge on which conversations between religious cultures, or cultures that claim ultimate authority, which could be a political culture, it's the bridge on which they meet to converse. Because instead of saying right, wrong, true, false, you're saying different. So tell me how your tradition understands X, and where did that come from, and what's your own sense of that for you as a person in the world, and how much does that influence what you personally believe? You know, like, most Jews think what they think, and if it happens to coordinate with Jewish tradition, that's nice. But honestly, I mean, I've run into Jews, you know, who are in favor of capital punishment. I try to argue that, you know, Jewish tradition really doesn't support capital punishment. I say, I don't care. you pick your issue, they'll say, I don't care. It happens to be that one, right? I mean, if I could prove to you that the Torah says that, you know, homosexuality is bad, which I can't prove to you, someone who's in favor of GLBT enfranchisement, I don't care. And that's probably a good I don't care.
Right? Judaism doesn't assert that we are the way, we are the only religion, right? Like other religions might assert.
It's the only way for us. It's the only...
For us.
Judaism.
Well, we chose God.
Yeah. Jewish tradition is caught between wanting to say it's got the ultimate truth about God and not wanting to say everyone else has to share that truth. Mm-hmm. That's the problem that Judaism has. Christianity, frankly, doesn't. They can say we've got the ultimate truth about God and everyone else has got to have it also. Makes sense on a certain level. Jewish tradition wanders back and forth around that.
But
in the Reform movement, you'll see next week.
The
Reconstructionist approach is I think, really different. It's really different.
You're Orthodox. It's really not wandering anywhere. But as you go down through the different sects of Judaism, it's like...
No.
Well, we don't really believe in this.
Orthodox rabbis would have a hard time saying you non-Jews have to become Jews in order to have salvation and get to heaven. I mean, it would be very hard to make that case out of anything that's like a Jewish source. They, by the way, are not going to say that, you know, that's really monotheism, what you're doing over there. Well, I'm sure that's monotheism. It kind of looks like monotheism. Maybe it might be monotheism, but it's not Judaism.
Natives are restless.
Yeah, I know.
So do you want to...
I know. I'm going to read the last underline really fast. Their sense of their place in the revelatory chain, the rabbis, denies neither the importance of revelation nor the obvious claim that God is the ultimate source of revelation. What had changed during the rabbinic period? This is why it's good to end here. A sense of how revelation is transmitted and where the content of revelation is located. The notion that revelation is a contentful, commanding set of instructions and admonitions from God has always been at the core of Jewish belief at the same time as we've seen, and that revelation actually commanded was never made entirely clear. If the Torah is ambiguous, the Talmud seems to revel in this uncertainty. This is not a weakness of Jewish tradition, but one of its strengths. Ours is a tradition that insists that God has spoken, yet is open to a variety of possibilities of how God spoke and what, in fact, God said. So my takeaway for you is, you know, if you are a sibling or you have siblings that are, of whom you are the parent, and you imagine what, you know, those adult kids say to each other about what they remember being taught or said about X in their home growing up by their parents. Or just ask them, like, what do you remember is the most important thing you learned in our house growing up? You rarely get the same piece of information, right? And they grew up in the same family. And I think that's, like they said, it's one of the greatnesses of Jewish tradition. Okay, so next week we'll go to medieval and modern theories of revelation. So we're sort of on target, time-wise.
Saturday morning, Torah Tracks, Rabbi Michael Ramberg will be starting our study of Ruth, the Book of Ruth, which we will continue on Saturday night, subsequently, a week later, with Rabbi Linda, Rabbi Jeremy, and Rabbi Helen.
Sunday congregational meeting, if you want to know who the new associate rabbi is.
So you're doing a tikkun on the Saturday night of Memorial Day?
Yes, we are.
Good for you guys.
Linda's
mainline.